Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So did you catch the two high-profile articles in the New York Times this week about Apple? One on Sunday on manufacturing, the other just yesterday about deplorable conditions in Apple's main Chinese plant. Keith Bradshaw, New York Times Hong Kong bureau chief, co-wrote the piece that ran on Sunday, How the U.S. Lost Out on iPhone Work. It's a story not just about Apple, but about the state of the U.S. manufacturing industry. Keith Bradshaw, welcome back to WNYC. Thank you very much for joining us. And I know it's very late Hong Kong time.
Well, it's just a little bit after midnight here, but I'm delighted to be on the show again.
It's late enough to start an interview. I want to play a clip from a recent debate, the South Carolina debate, where this topic came up.
Apple Computer is a breathtakingly important American company. Senator Santorum is one of the most respected companies in the country. It is based in the United States, has some employees here, about 40-something thousand, I think 46,000, most of them in retail stores and at the headquarters. 500,000 of them are in China. As a president of the United States, what do you do about that?
I'm the only person on this stage that will do something about it. I do dramatic things that send a signal. Apple, you have all those employees over there. You make all those profits over there. If you want to bring that money back, if you bring it back and invest it in plant and equipment here in Charleston, you pay nothing. You put that money to work. If you invest it, you pay nothing.
So there's Rick Santorum answering the Apple question. And your story, Keith, begins with an anecdote about President Obama asking Steve Jobs a very direct question over dinner. What will it take to get iPhones manufactured here in the U.S.? And Jobs' response was, it's not going to happen. So what do you think when you hear politicians talking about bringing Apple back to the United States?
It's going to be very tough for the reasons we're describing in the series. There are a number of reasons why companies started to move to China. But now that they've moved, it's very hard to get them to move back. It's one thing to try to persuade a company that is still in the United States not to leave, but that's not the case with Apple. They have a vast supply line that in turn is very deeply tied into the fabric of southeastern China, and you can't easily rip it out of the fabric. It's not just the companies, the final assembly of the products. It's that so many of the components now, as in almost all of the components, are made in southeastern China as well. And some of the components are flown in, but it's not just the assembly, it's even the sub-assemblies are overwhelmingly being done in southern China. And that gives you a lot more competition. For example, one company was looking at where it would buy copper wire and even looked around other places. If it were to move its factory elsewhere, whether it's the United States or elsewhere, they might have one copper wire factory nearby. In southeastern China, they had six different copper wire companies all competing tooth and nail for the contract. They knew that their copper wire prices would never be that high. You take that across lots of different components, you end up with a very, very low-cost place in which to do the manufacturing. And that's how Apple started moving production there. And then the more they moved there, the more they made it an even more thoroughly integrated manufacturing center, to the point that now a lot of consumer electronics, and particularly cell phone manufacturing, is in southeastern China.
So what draws companies like Apple to set up that kind of web of suppliers and sub-suppliers and final product factories there? Is it simply the cheap labor?
It's not just the cheap labor. It is the variety of suppliers, which means the competition helps hold the prices down. It is the excellent infrastructure. You've got world-class ports, world-class superhighways, excellent airports that are as large or larger than big American airports and are much newer, very good telecommunications and internet connections. But it's also lower labor costs. And regulations, including regulations against forming unions, that mean that that companies feel as though the they're sure that nothing's going to interrupt the production process, which is tends to be their main concern.
Steve Jobs was known as someone who at least wanted to be known as a person with progressive values. Did you get any sense that Steve Jobs, before he died, felt guilty about placing these jobs overseas in the numbers that he has?
I don't know, and I wouldn't be able to discuss that. My role was very much on the China side, not on the Steve Jobs side.
How about other Apple executives who you interviewed?
I wouldn't limit it to Apple. I would say that you talk to a lot of American executives, and they are troubled by the competitiveness gap between the United States and China. But they feel as though if they do not move production to China, then they may lose out in the marketplace to companies that do move production to China, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that everybody feels as though they need to move. And that may not change unless you see, for example, trade barriers erected in the United States, in which case companies may feel a need to produce in the United States for the American market, or unless you get some kind of a backlash in the United States against the purchase of foreign products. But if you look at, for example, autos, I used to be the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times, right, 1996 to 2002. And I think 25 years ago, you had Detroit auto workers on a couple of famous occasions even smashing Japanese cars with sledgehammers to express their frustration and calling for trade barriers and also calling for Americans to show a preference for buying American-made cars. And 25 years later, the Detroit's share of the U.S. auto market is considerably lower than it was then, and there seems to be very little public resistance to the purchase of Japanese-made cars, even though if you look at, for example, the sudden acceleration scandal that Toyota had a while back, what it really underlined in all the documents and all that came out then was just how Japanese the process still is. Most of the engineers and all of the decisions were being made in Japan, even though the assembly of the vehicles, in the case of Toyota, for example, is often done at assembly plants in the United States.
Keith Bratcher, Hong Kong bureau chief for the New York Times, joining us on his article about Apple manufacturing jobs not coming back to the United States. And we will get to the often deplorable conditions within some of these factories in a bit that were so shockingly reported in yesterday's Times. But there's an anecdote in your story that I'd like you to tell. A few weeks before the release of the new iPhone, Apple decides that they want to tweak the design of the screen. What happened next?
This was Steve Jobs wanting a screen that wouldn't get easily scratched by keys if you had it in your pocket. He had gone around with a prototype and in his pocket, and the screen looked like a mess after a few weeks. And so he told his executives, this isn't acceptable, even though we only have 6 weeks to go before the before this product begins to be in mass shipments. I want a different screen on it. And he wanted a glass screen on it, which wouldn't scratch. It would be a very high high durability, high scratch resistance screen. One of his executives immediately got on a plane to China, because they knew that they had to come to Shenzhen, which is next to Hong Kong, where I am, because that's the place where you can get almost anything done quickly. They also talked very quickly to some of the glass manufacturers. They did opt to buy glass from Corning, but as Corning says, they need to be where their market is, and right now the market for a lot of glass, particularly for consumer electronics, is in southern China. So they were supplying in southern China the glass screens.
But there's also a quick response, yes, element to this that I found fascinating. I'm going to read from your article. New screens began arriving at the plant near midnight. A foreman immediately roused 8,000 workers inside the company's dormitories, according to the executive. Each employee was given a biscuit and a cup of tea, guided to a workstation, and within half an hour started a 12-hour shift, fitting glass screens into beveled frames. Within 96 hours, the plant was producing over 10,000 iPhones a day. So I guess the question is, maybe a willfully naive question, couldn't that happen here in the United States?
I think you'd have trouble finding a place where workers would be willing to be roused at midnight with a cup of tea and biscuits in order to spend 12 hours popping something into place.
People sure line up quickly when there are help wanted signs and ads. You know, some of those lines are legendary. But what are the dormitories? Describe the scene of 8,000 workers living in dormitories that are owned by their employer. That's something you don't see in the United States.
It really isn't. And in the case of Foxconn, their largest operation has more like a couple hundred thousand workers. So you're only talking about a couple of dormitories worth. You look at BYD, the big battery company, and that has rows of 17-story apartment buildings with dormitories, bunk beds in each room, full of workers. What you see in China has been, and this is starting to change, has been a somewhat different industrial model in which companies provide housing, which was sort of a tradition coming out of Mao. You provide essentially free housing and one meal a day, and then you sell meals for other meals during the day to workers, and they've tended to be migrant workers coming long distances. So they don't already have housing, which was another reason why the companies tended to build dormitories. Migrant workers coming long distances from the farming areas that had the most of the Chinese population up until the last few years. Now, that is just beginning to change now. Foxconn, partly in reaction to, or mainly in reaction to the spate of suicides they had a year ago, decided that they didn't really want in the dormitory business after all, and they are in the process of moving away. They're beginning to move away from that, and they're also beginning to move more of their production to factories farther inland that are in areas that are not quite as congested and far from the sources of labor like Shenzhen. So you're seeing some movement within China, but you still do have at many factories these just endless rows of dormitories packed with workers, and they tend to be people who, if you talk to them, they desperately miss their families, and they're all there usually because they only want to work 2 or 3 years, go back, open a small shop or whatever. There's a lot of entrepreneurialism you find among these young people. They want to earn as much as they can in 2 or 3 years and go back to their families and go back to their friends and go back to their villages. And during that time, they accept working conditions that I think a lot of Americans would regard as unacceptable, as well as the living conditions as well.
And some of our listeners are familiar with the This American Life piece with Mike Daisy that featured his trip to Foxconn, an expose on the working conditions there. And I want to ask you along those lines, and my guest is Keith Bradshaw, New York Times bureau chief in Hong Kong, who wrote about Apple manufacturing plants there, at least in China. The follow-up piece that ran in the Times yesterday about the human cost of Apple's manufacturing. This is a profile of the Foxconn manufacturing facility in Chengdu. This American Life piece somewhat focused on a massive explosion at Foxconn last year, then a rash of suicide attempts. There was a heartbreaking hour-long show that This American Life did on that. But in the explosion, two people were killed immediately and over a dozen others hurt. In general, according to the Times article, employees work excessive overtime, in some cases 7 days a week, and live in these crowded dorms. Some say they stand so long that their legs swell until they can hardly walk. The company's suppliers reportedly have improperly disposed of hazardous waste and falsified records, according to company reports and advocacy groups. It sounds like a horror show. It sounds like Upton in Sinclair's The Jungle, you know, a century later and half a world away.
And you see it in factory after factory in China. The working conditions are not what Americans would accept at all. And yet Americans implicitly accept them by buying the products they produce. For example, when you go into Chinese factories, you almost never see backs on the stools. It's all backless stools with people sitting on them 10 and 12 hours a day doing the same task over and over and over again. And it's horrible on the back, and yet you've had, until the last several years, a seemingly unlimited supply of 20-year-olds. And if anybody complained, there was always somebody else outside the gate willing to take their job under the same really, really unpleasant conditions.
So, listeners, we'll take a few phone calls on this. In particular, if you're an Apple aficionado, we hear people refer to the cult of Apple, having to do with their consumers, not their workers. But if that's you, call in and tell us if any of these recent reports about Apple's manufacturing process and conditions in overseas plants have made you think twice. I'll admit, reading that Times article yesterday, I don't have an iPhone. I do have an iPad. It made me want to throw it in the Hudson River. But how are you processing this? I don't know how I'm processing this. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Keith, before we take a break and take some calls, who's responsible for these conditions? The Chinese government, international regulators, Apple itself?
All of them. The Chinese, particularly municipal regulators, have often been mostly interested in maximizing economic growth. They want their city to be able to say, in the frequent performance evaluations that everybody gets before they get transferred to their next post in another town, they want their city to be able to say, okay, I grew my city's economic output by whatever, 15%, 20% last year, and they often don't care so much about how they do it. They've repeatedly put economic growth rates ahead of environmental protection and labor protection. In turn, then, you also get companies that see their competitors not having to pay high labor costs, not having to follow, to make expensive investments in environmental or environmental controls or in worker safety equipment. And so they don't necessarily make all those investments themselves. And it varies by company, and it varies by city within China. And then finally, American consumers. Ultimately, at the end of the day, what companies do tends to be what they think is the profit-maximizing decision. And to the extent that consumers don't care, then consumers also play a role.
We will take your phone calls on this, and our lines all lit up immediately as soon as I asked the question. So our lines are full, but you can also post to our comments page at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show via Twitter, via Facebook. On our Facebook page, Anne writes, it's made me feel guilty because it hasn't changed my addiction to all things Apple. David wrote on our Facebook page, the pressure put on these workers is just another piece of evidence of why it's wrong to insist on buying the latest gadget because it has one or two little upgrades. And Kelly on Facebook wrote, frankly, Apple has set itself up to be held to a higher standard, not just because their products are cool, but because they use Gandhi in an ad. It's for them to lead the pack, not get dragged along. So we'll hear what more of you have to think as we continue with Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong bureau chief for The New York Times, in a minute. Brian Lehr on WNYC. My guest is Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong correspondent and bureau chief for the New York Times, talking about the series of articles they've had on Apple manufacturing plants in China and the working conditions there and the jobs not coming back to the United States. Monday, by the way, after a debateless weekend before the Florida primary, we will do political analysis with ABC's Jake Tapper to start us off here Monday morning at 10. And the director of intelligence analysis for the NYPD, Mitchell Silbert, talks about his new book, The Al-Qaeda Factor. Join us Monday and every weekday at 10 here on WNYC, The Brian Lehr Show. Let's go to the phones for Keith Bradshaw. James in Manhattan. Hi, James. You're on WNYC.
Hi. How are you?
Okay.
I just wanted to say, I just wonder if this is if this information is going to change people's notions about Steve Jobs, the prophet of progressivism. I mean, after all, he was nothing more and nothing less than a very, very successful capitalist. I mean, he made Apple into a very, very profitable company by paying very close attention to the interest of his shareholders, namely the pursuit of profit by keeping costs low, and then on the flip side, by satisfying the customer and creating a product or a set of products that he was able to charge real premium prices for over and above what they might normally cost from competitors, because people thought they were cool or they were the latest thing to have. And of course, he gave very little thought, apparently, to the fate of the workers. Now, the important point, though, as far as the working conditions in the Chinese factories, is not to compare those conditions to working conditions in the developed world West or in Europe or the United States, but rather to compare, you know, why do those workers choose to leave the farm and take those jobs? Apparently, in their own minds, however marginal they may feel, they probably feel that they will be better off rather than worse off, even with the you know, the
working conditions that they have, if they survive. But James, thank you very much. You put a lot of important content out on the table. And Keith Bradshaw, let me start with the first part of his question, which is this going to pop the bubble of the Steve Jobs image? Of course, there was, you know, so much reverie when he passed away recently, and this part of the story was out there, and we talked about it on this show as part of the whole package of Steve Jobs, along with the positive. But it really didn't get a lot of traction in most places because people just wanted to think about their iPads and iPods and everything else. So do you think this is going to pop the image of Steve Jobs if people start talking about this more?
If people do really focus on this, then it certainly does not help his image. His image was partly based on producing products that people love, and he never focused publicly, to my knowledge, on how the manufacturing products work. He presented himself as a prophet of rapidly evolving, extremely high-quality products. And what the articles this week in the New York Times have tried to point out is how Apple was able to achieve that. Now, as another dimension, I guess, on Steve Jobs, in about 10 years ago, he was involved in a controversy over the alleged repricing of options. And one of the things that was interesting then was that Steve Jobs, in rearranging his own compensation package, cut by 80% the number of shares he was getting, of Apple shares he was getting. He would have been far richer when he passed away had he actually placed a bigger bet on Apple. But rather than have, I think it was options for 50 million shares that might, if that would, that he would get if the stock price went up rather considerably, he chose instead to get to only 10 million shares and essentially lock in that he would get them at only a small increase in price.
Why?
So he was not somebody who was convinced that Apple was going to become the absolutely dominant company that it became.
Well, I'm not sure how else to...
It may have been then a calculation that he wanted to take to do whatever he needed to do to hold down costs.
Is there any element within the media, say at the New York Times, that thinks that Apple is a little more vulnerable now that Jobs is dead, that you can start to probe a little more and come out with stories like this?
Absolutely not. The story was this package has been in the reporting for a long time.
Alan, so
it's not like this. We started this after Jobs. This was already underway before Jobs stepped down.
Alan in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello, Alan.
Hello, guys. How are you guys?
Okay.
Good. I mean, I'm calling from an iPhone now, and I was just saying that, you know,
good quality.
There's nothing I could do now, you know, as far as fair practices. I mean, if a company comes out and says, listen, all of our employees are treated right, they're all accounted for, they're all, you know, like family to us, then that'll open my eyes. But there's no other phone company out there that does that. I mean, there's vitamins and food companies that are either organic or they're friendly to their employees, and I'll always watch out for that. But until a phone company comes out and says that, you know, we're going to try to respect the earth and get the minerals from the gold from a certain friendly place and all that, you know, friendly stuff, then I'll be there. But until then, there's nothing I can do about it, you know. So as an American, I mean, I love the phone, and I wouldn't go anywhere else. So I hope that they go in the right direction. But, I mean, you know how mankind is. I mean, you know, when money talks,
Alan, I hear you. And it certainly is fair and accurate to say, and Keith, I think you'll agree, that there may not be a really, you know, ethical cell phone out there on the market anywhere. We've done shows before on the kind of blood minerals that go into producing cell phones on a very widespread basis. But also, Alan is kind of throwing up his hands and saying, well, what can we do about it if we want to live in the world and use products that are available? This is kind of what goes on out there. But there are examples, aren't there, like maybe with Nike and other companies, where there really was a very widespread consumer backlash after overseas factory working conditions were revealed and things actually did start to change. So could we be at a moment like that for Apple?
There's definitely more that Apple could do. And the question is, are they going to decide to do this, to do more? They could make available where their factories are. They could press their suppliers harder to make changes. I remember I did a story actually now a year ago on rare earth metals, which and how Apple relies on, like everybody, the entire world, on heavy rare earths that tend to come out of southern China. And I went to a village in southern China and interviewed a farmer, and his land had been ruined. He and his family had been on it for generations, but the toxic runoff from one of these illegal rare earth mines had destroyed it. I went to the mine, and some thugs told me, we're going to carve you up like an animal in a slaughterhouse and burn your car, and I left. And it was really, it's a thuggish industry. But when I asked Apple, well, what are you doing to try to avoid relying on these highly environmentally destructive industries in southern China that produce the heavy rare earths that are what make your cell phone vibrate and deuce, and a lot of little chips that make an iPhone work. There are about 600, 700 multi-layer ceramic capacitors in an iPhone that give it a lot of its capabilities versus, say, only 150 or so in a traditional non-smartphone. But so I asked them, and they just didn't want to discuss it. So they've not a company that's wanted to get into the details of where they're getting their materials, how they're processing them, and what kind of standards they're setting for suppliers.
That's a shame. Although in your article, there was a slightly more positive take on it, which was that some former Apple executives say there is an unresolved tension within the company. Executives want to improve conditions within the factories, but that dedication falters when it conflicts with crucial supplier relationships or the fast delivery of new products. Yes?
That's a dilemma for every company. They all face that dilemma in terms of how do you rank your priorities.
Anderson in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Anderson.
Yes, hi. I'm originally from Brazil, and Brazil recently passed a law to give Foxconn huge tax incentives. So they are actually, I believe, now starting operations in Brazil, manufacturing products for Apple. Now, Brazil, of course, does not have the same salaries that the United States has, but Brazil has a minimum wage that's much higher than what anybody can make in China. So Foxconn, you know, definitely, you know what they're doing. So they found a place with a good workforce to make their products for Apple. So that makes me think that they could definitely try to do this in the United States. We have areas that are completely depressed with nothing going on. So, you know, I believe there's got to be a way to make some of their products here, because the people that buy Apple products, they're young people. They have opinions. So we should, you know, pressure Apple to at least make some of their products here.
Anderson, I'm curious how you think we should see the workers at these plants in Foxconn, if they start manufacturing for Apple in Brazil, and from what you've heard about China. Brazil, Russia, India, China, the so-called BRIC countries that have rising economies right now. On the one hand, the workers are being exploited and even endangered in the way that we've been hearing. But on the other hand, reporters say if you ask these workers, would they rather be back on the farm living as subsistence agriculture peasants or whatever, or rather be in these factories and see these factory jobs as an opportunity for them and their families, that they certainly would rather be there. And so our perception is too negative, you know, of the context of the whole thing. Coming from Brazil, what's your opinion of that?
Well, the workforce that's going to work at Foxconn making Apple screens are different from the Chinese perspective, because they are not going to be farm workers. They're not going to be people from the countryside. They are actually urban young people, you know, between the age of 18 to 25. They so it's a different workforce. Then they are definitely going to be happy to be able to get a job in that kind of sector, but they will not. Brazil has a lot of labor laws, the unions there. The government actually does a fairly good job making sure people are treated fairly at the workplace. So they're not going to be sitting 12 hours a day on a backless stool, definitely not. So the companies, they will have to at least treat the people fairly there. They're not going to be doing 12-hour shifts, that's for sure.
So there's going to be a difference between Brazil and China. We're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. And Keith Bradshaw, we are just about out of time, and I thank you for giving us so much time after midnight in Hong Kong. Do you think there is a phone that's kind of more ethically manufactured than other phones if people wanted to buy by that standard, or haven't you ever looked into that?
I haven't tried to compare the ethics. I do know that, for example, on materials, like rare earth metals, for example, nobody's been able to figure out a way to source a truly green line of production. And then you look at it across different materials, look at it for factories. I have not seen somebody try to do a truly green with high worker safety and everything else standards phones. But different companies have tried to different extents to try to improve standards.
And we'll follow up on that, because there are some consumer groups who try to describe, if not rank, phones in those terms. And obviously, there's a lot of interest in our audience, and even more interest after the two articles that have run about Apple factories and working conditions there in China in the New York Times. Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong bureau chief for the Times, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer in WNYC, coming up in a minute. We'll break down last night's debate. We'll have some clips, including Mitt Romney being more combative than at any other time in a debate. This was his prescription. Did he pull it off? We'll talk to Jennifer Rubin, blogger for The Washington Post, and play some excerpts. Stay with us. Also, there's a great conversation breaking out on our Facebook page right now in relation to the Keith Bradshaw Apple conversation. If you want to join it, just go to Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC. Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC if you want to keep our last conversation going.